Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. Our guest today is Tyler Goldman, and he's the CEO of Deezer US. But first, let's talk about Happy Birthday, the song. All of us grew up singing Happy Birthday to You. We all know it so well, and chances are, at the next birthday you go to, you're going to sing it to someone. Now, you've probably wondered why, when you go to a restaurant, they sing a song that's kind of a lame version of Happy Birthday. It's never the same. Well, here's why. The song isn't in the public domain, believe it or not. Everybody thinks it's just a children's song that's been around forever, and even though it has, the copyright is actually owned by Warner Chappell, who makes about $2 million a year off this copyright. Now, Warner Chappell has been very aggressive in their lawsuits over this song through the years, and obviously there's a lot of hard feelings over the whole thing. And as a result, there's a class action suit that's trying to get the song to return into the public domain. There's been a number of lawsuits in the past, and every time Warner Chappell has prevailed, but this time may be different. The reason why was a librarian at the University of Louisville found a document that dates back to 1893. The person that actually wrote the song, the two people that wrote the song, they were sisters, Mildred and Patty Hill. And the song was originally called Good Morning to All, and it was put in a children's book in 1893, and then it was filed away, and nobody found it until recently. Actually, the files were given to the University of Louisville in the 50s, filed, nobody kept track of them, and now they just reappeared. Kind of interesting, had a good time here. Now, the way Warner Chappell came to own the copyright was they bought a publishing company called Sumi Company in 1935, and this was just part of the catalog. But they assumed that they owned it from there, and it wasn't in the public domain. And the fact of the matter is, it looks like it is now in the public domain. And now Happy Birthday will be able to be sung in restaurants and in schools and just about everywhere, royalty-free. Now, the lawsuit has not concluded yet, but it looks pretty good given this new piece of evidence. So Happy Birthday, the song, may be in the public domain pretty soon. Hooray for that. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Also, take your career to the next level with my Music Prosperity Breakthrough program at musicprosperitybreakthrough.com. Next thing I want to talk about is the questions that you should ask before booking a session. Now, we all have home studios. Everybody has a home studio, and some of them are more sophisticated than others. And if you have one of those where you can actually track a band, chances are, sooner or later, someone is going to want to come in to use your studio. So in order for the session to go really well, and if someone is paying you, in order to get paid a reasonable fee, there's a number of questions that you should ask. The very first one is, how many songs do you intend to do? And obviously, the more songs someone wants to record, the longer it's going to take, and the longer it's going to take impacts your life, and also the more they should be willing to pay or trade. The next question is, who's involved? Who are the players? Is there a producer? Who's the engineer? Who's the producer? You want to know all those things, because if there are people that you're aware of, it also gives you an idea of what to expect. You have an idea of what kind of equipment they might be bringing, for instance. It also gives you an idea of the level of experience, which will also tell you how fast things will probably go and how good it will sound as well. The third thing is, when is the start time? And if somebody tells you 2 p.m., what does that mean exactly? Is that the downbeat or is that the load-in time? And a lot of times, even bands get this mixed up. You say 2 o'clock, and some of them are just getting there at 2 o'clock, and others are set up and ready to go. So that should be very, very clear to everyone. And the next question would be, what's the instrumentation? And is everyone going to be playing at the same time? Very important, because it lets you know how many microphones, how many headphones you're going to need, where you're going to set everyone up, for instance, and it kind of gives you an idea of the level of complexity that you're up against. The next question is all about the drum kit. How many toms, for instance, does the drummer have? Does he have single or double bass drums? Is he right or left-handed? all of these things you need to know. And it's very important, the toms issue especially, because some drummers, of course, can get by with one or two toms and others need five. And it all makes a big difference, and it makes a difference on the space that you have to allow for the drummer. Are there going to be any acoustic instruments involved? And of course, acoustic instruments mean that there has to be some sort of isolation in order for them to sound good. And of course, isolation means that our setup is probably going to be a lot different than if there are no acoustic instruments. Are all the players going to be playing at once? So if there's five people in the band, do they all expect to play at once? Or will there only be the drummer and the bass player, the drummer and guitar player and singer? How many people are going to be playing? It makes a big difference. What kind of gear are they going to be bringing? Very important. Again, for guitar players, for instance, and bass players, are you going to see an SVT and a 100-watt Marshall? Or are they going to be coming with smaller amps or going direct? Will they be using house gear, for instance? Do they expect to use the gear that you have on hand? Will they be bringing their own outboard gear and microphones? Some sophisticated players will do that, especially studio players, may bring their own signal path in, which is good to know beforehand so you don't set some things up that you don't need to, for instance. And finally, will they be playing to a click track or loops? So again, you have to know this in advance so you can be ready for it, so you can set things up so the session goes efficiently. So these are just some of the questions that you should ask before a session if someone is coming into your studio. And the reason is you want everything to go smoothly, you want it to go quickly, you want everybody to be happy with the least amount of hassle, and this is the best way to do it. You may not be familiar with Deezer unless you're a Sonos user, but the streaming music service has over 16 million active users in 180 countries. My guest today is Tyler Goldman, an online business veteran who's the CEO of Deezer US. I spoke with Tyler from his office in San Francisco. So Tyler, tell me about what you're doing before Deezer.
So generally, Deezer has grown into the second largest subscription service for music, or audio, we should say, globally. And it's taken a slightly different approach to the market, than others in a couple of key ways, and has continued to grow, pretty steadily. And obviously, the overall market's growing as well, which is also helpful.
What were you doing before Deezer?
So I've done a number of things. I'm just old.
Join the club.
I've been doing digital media for 20 plus years now. So I've had a number of startups, and I've been involved in a number of startups on the publishing side, generally around digital content. And I've done music, done celebrity gossip, sports, movies, television, you name it.
Cool. A little bit of everything, huh?
A little bit of everything, but a lot of similar things, which is it's really been about, how do you effectively use this, great medium of internet or IP delivered, channel to build better valued services for consumers. So it's been all consumer facing digital media.
So now that you're at Deezer, how does that work in terms of a better value for the consumer?
There's a big challenge in this category, which is that, number one, the services are still evolving in creating that value proposition. But number two is, historically, if you look at the data, consumers have not necessarily valued music in the same way they valued video content, particularly TV and film, which is where, what I've done before. So I think the primary focus for me and for Deezer and I think true for the industry is how do you create more value in our product, in our offering? And in that way, I think that we've approached it differently than others. And I can name a couple of the ways we're doing it, but I would say the primary ways are, number one is we're looking at this as there's lots of different types of audio consumers that have different needs. And we're really trying to figure out how to super serve eventually everyone, but that's a big challenge to start with. So we're looking at different parts of the market, how to do that. Number two, obviously, we're trying to build the best product that does super serve them. And then three, from a distribution marketing standpoint, we've taken a slightly different view of others. And one is we're quite global in our business. And two, in a lot of cases, we've partnered with mobile carriers to help educate and reach a larger part of the market.
You haven't done that in the U.S., though, yet, have you?
We've done it with AT&T with their prepaid business called Cricket.
Oh, yes, right. Okay.
And that's actually growing very well, very fast. People really underrated. There was a business there before we got involved called Move Music, which was the second largest service in the U.S. I think it's gotten probably less coverage because of the demographic. It's not the Digirati demographic. But what's really interesting about Move, and I know you cover the space thoroughly, is that Move had a very high penetration within the Cricket audience. You know, there's very few places in the world where subscription services have reached a high level of penetration. You know, Scandinavia with Spotify, France with Deezer are probably the two primary examples. But Move had a very high paying, you know, $10 a month subscription service in his audience, you know, 3 years ago. And the reason why they did was they had a very tailored offering for the audience. And so we've gone in and done that and increased the value proposition, because before it was more of a service that was built on download and listen to a streaming service. And we also have a very attractive price point for that audience, which is $5.50.
Oh, yeah, that is good.
So that shows you, it combines kind of two of the factors I told you, which is it's a very targeted, tailored offering, and it's distributed through a mobile carrier partner.
So how do you get to that $5.50? I guess it's partially subsidized by the carrier, right? It has to be, because the labels would never go for a price like that, or they haven't so far.
No, the labels, it's shot, believe it or not, the labels went for pricing like that. This was an audience that historically has not bought any music. In the same way the labels have given discounted pricing for college students, the labels smartly realize that this is an audience that generally is not paying for services. And the service is a little bit different than our $9.99 product. And it's tailored not just feature-wise and product-wise, but also editorial-wise for this audience. And again, I think that's where services are going. The idea that you have one service, one price, one product for everyone. You know, what I, you know, was telling, I was explaining this to my son, which is, you know, one size fits all is good for socks generally, because he was trying on my socks, but, you know, it's not really good for media products.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, how do you feel about that in terms of what's the ideal price?
You know, I think it depends on the product. I think there'll be more than one product in the marketplace. You know, right now you have basically free with YouTube. You know, you've got free radio products. You've got paid radio products. You've got paid levels of on demand, and then you've got higher levels. I mean, we go everywhere from $5.50 with our Deezer product for Cricket to $19.99 for Deezer Elite, which is our high fidelity product with Sonos. And they're different products geared towards different audiences.
Well, let's talk about high-res audio, which your elite tier is providing. I'm a big, obviously I'm an audio guy, so I come from that space, and however you can supply a high-res product, you know, I'm for. Do people really care?
Again, it depends on the audience. For home audio listeners, it's very important. For current mobile users who are, you know, predominantly or close to exclusively mobile, it matters less. And that's what I'm saying is audio listeners, you're talking about several billion people that listen to music, you know what I mean, on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
They by not just by country, but actually more by behavior, have different types of listening behaviors. And so a high fidelity product matters to those users quite a bit who are home audio listeners. You know, their feeling has always been, you know, when we started to approach this market, the data clearly reflected is they felt the services were getting better and better, and they were avidly interested in the features, but they thought they were sacrificing sound quality.
Yeah.
And as you know, it sounds like you've got an audio engineering background. There's not a reason why you have to sacrifice sound quality to have better features.
Well, not anymore, that's for sure.
No, but it has been true, you know what I mean, for the last 10 years, right? Which is if you really wanted great features of a streaming service, you were sacrificing the sound quality.
Yeah, right. Right. Well, what do you qualify as a high fidelity product when you ingest something? What are you looking for from your providers, from the record labels?
Yeah. So right now we're serving FLAC files, and we found kind of that's the sweet spot. for the home audio enthusiasts. There's clearly some other, there's a smaller percentage that are looking, you know what I mean, for 24-bit stuff. But we're quite happy, you know, we've gotten very good response for the level that we're serving at, which is significantly higher, as you know, than what's available, you know what I mean, in standard services.
Yeah. Yeah. So in other words, for you to qualify it as a high-res product, you don't really do that. You just say to the record labels, give us a FLAC file, right?
Well, we obviously do our own encoding, right? They give us a source video.
Yeah.
And we're using 16-bit today, 16-bit 44.1. So, you know, FLAC lossless. So that to us is a demonstrable difference, you know what I mean, from current, you know what I mean, MP3 services. So that's where we found the sweet spot. Again, I'm not saying there isn't a subpart of that market that would even be interested in something, you know, higher.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the lion's share of the market, we've noticed an enormous difference for home audio listeners. You know, generally, if you look at the home audio listeners, they have very different setups at home mm-hmm. than people who don't listen at home in terms of speakers, amps, you know what I mean, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very noticeable difference. And generally, they want the best of the best. And we're able to provide that.
So,
you know, versus a 320 kilobit stream on an MP3.
Okay, so what you're asking for from a record label, for instance, is basically your CD master, right?
We're asking for the best possible source they have, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And then we're encoding from that.
Okay, that makes sense. So what's your feeling about the free tier?
So we have a freemium product, not in the U.S., but globally we have a freemium product. I think the free tier has been a very effective means for introducing people to the offering. Again, if you look at the number of people that were subscribing to music 3 years ago versus the numbers today, obviously it's a growing industry and we're still early, but there are magnitudes of order difference. And I think freemium has been a big part of that because we're talking about introducing a new product service.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a better mousetrap. It's a new service that people have to understand how it works. And freemium has been very important to getting there. I think the freemium, again, that's probably, if I were a rights holder, that would be a bigger issue, are the free services that don't have a premium attached to it, where there's no freemium model like YouTube.
Yeah, right.
I think that very little attention gets paid to where most of the free is happening. Most of the free is not happening in the freemium tier of a paid service like Deezer. It's happening, or Spotify, it's happening on YouTube.
You haven't launched your free tier in the U.S., though, have you?
No, we haven't. And in fact, even the paid tier today is, we've launched it to different market segments, which is audio enthusiasts with Sonos and Bose. And we've launched it with AT&T to their customers. But otherwise, Deezer is not available direct to consumer today.
So what's your plan for that? I mean, sooner or later, you have to roll that out.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to be thoughtful about it, which is right now we're continuing to super serve different audiences. As we've started to super serve different audiences, we've built out features that we think make our product incredibly valuable to large numbers of consumers.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, you know what I mean, we will then focus in on a broader, you know, marketing effort to consumers directly that, you know, outside of any tier. But I think we want to be thoughtful about it. I think one of the things that the industry has faced is the value proposition has not increased enough in the U.S. to make it a mass market product. And I think you see that with Apple's launch.
Yeah.
So right now, instead of just focusing in on trying to reach the most number of consumers in the U.S., we're really focusing in on creating more and more value for the consumers we do reach.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as someone who's done digital for 20 years, one of the things you learn is you could never have your product be valuable enough.
Yeah.
And so in the same way, you know, Facebook started just doing one college, then doing 8 colleges, then doing colleges. It really didn't have a B2C launch for four or five years.
Mm-hmm.
But what they did was they greatly improved their product as they went along. And so while we think we've got a tremendous product today that's as good or better than any product in the market, we still think to make it a mass market product, meaning reach 50 million plus paid users, we need to continue to increase the value proposition of our offering.
So do you have a time frame when you're going to launch?
You mean just on a direct? It'll be soon. No. I mean, I think we've seen tremendous success with the ones we've done in the U.S. The High Fidelity product has been very well received, not just by the number of subscribers, but by the feedback and very low churn, meaning they're enjoying the product and have very active usage. Mm-hmm. Same thing with our audience on prepaid, which despite the fact that it's prepaid, meaning they're not locked into any kind of contract with their carrier, we have very low churn. So we clearly are doing something right with our products. But again, because we've evolved them. And so I think we're getting to the point now where it does make sense to bring a market direct to consumer.
What's your plan to market to the U.S.? Because really, Deezer has been flying under the radar for most users. The other thing about that is it really takes a lot to have someone change from an existing service that they're on right now, as we've been seeing with Apple Music, for instance. So what's your plans on that?
I would say two things. Number one is almost no one's on a service in the U.S., so it's not necessarily about getting someone to change. We've noticed this in our efforts with AT&T and our efforts with Sonos and Bose. We're not marketing to people who are going to switch services. We're marketing, you know, meaning getting subscribers in good numbers from people who don't have a service. So that's first. Second is we need to super serve these audiences. So we have the best home audio product in the marketplace in the U.S., and we've been growing that audience. So while we're quote unquote under the radar, you know, we're probably, you know, with what we've done, and also, you know, obviously we acquired Stitcher, which also creates additional value for our products. Mm-hmm. You know, we're one of the top services in the U.S. in just number of subscribers. So, you know, when you add in our Cricket numbers and our AT&T and you add in what we've done with home audio, we're growing really quickly and have a sizable amount. Mm-hmm. Again, to get to 25 to 50 million, it's another big step, right?
Yeah.
But while we're under the radar, we've been very effective. And I think you look at companies, and not to discredit what anyone has done, but if you look at the other players in the U.S., they haven't really achieved any kind of scale, even though they've been in the U.S. for 4 or 5 or 6 or 7, or in some cases 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the Googles, the RDOs, the Rhapsodies, the et cetera, they don't have a large U.S. audience.
Well, if you look at Spotify, for instance, you know, I would say that it's a growing audience in the U.S., but right now they may not have market penetration, but they have mental penetration, if you know what I mean, because everybody knows who they are, and I think that's what you're up against. So
yes and no. I think yes in terms of awareness, but again, we've done our own research. There's still not high awareness among consumers at a broad level. Number two is this is really early days, and at the end of the day, you know, the best offering is what's going to win. And it's like in any category, Netflix eventually produced the best offering and scaled very quickly. Facebook had a much better offering than MySpace, even though Facebook for a large time was 10% the size and scale. Mm-hmm. So I think for us, it's about the best offering. And I think we're in the second inning, you know what I mean? Not the seventh or eighth inning.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really happy with the success we've had in the market segments we've gone after. We're also not going slowly. It's not like we're a small tier player. We're the second largest in the world. So when we get these audiences like home audio, remember, we're not just getting them in the U.S. We're getting them across 180 countries. And the home audio user in Tokyo and Berlin, Sao Paulo, and Mexico City have very similar needs as the home audio listener in Chicago. So what we've done here has translated for us globally also.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So how does the U.S. market differ from the rest of the world?
In terms of consumers, what we found is consumers have relatively similar desires and interest in a service. Content is local to a large extent, very underestimated how local content is. You know, most markets, local content is 50% or more of consumption.
Yeah.
So, you know, localizing the product to each market is something that Deezer's done very well. But overall behaviors are quite similar. And I think that the winners in this category will definitely be global, because you need to amortize your investment cost in the service on a global basis.
Yeah, yeah. Is it a problem to roll out to different countries?
It's definitely hard. Yeah. I mean, it's to do it well. I mean, to roll out is easy, but to do it well is hard. Because again, what you're really trying to do is, if you can look at audience segments could be geographic, right? A user in Ukraine is going to have very different interests than the user in Colombia in their what they're consuming and editorially, et cetera. You also have difference demographically, right? Which is, like I said, someone and behaviorally, right? Where someone who's a home audio listener who's 47 is very different from someone who's 17 and a mobile user.
Yeah.
You have people who are very in certain genres of music, and they have different needs. So someone who cares about jazz and classical is very different from someone who cares about dance, who's very different than someone, again, we haven't even talked about non-music content, which is becoming a bigger part of Deezer, which is people who are interested in news and politics.
Oh, yeah. Give me that. Tell me about that.
So we bought Stitcher about a year ago. It's been almost a year.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is, number one, is people who want an audio solution and want a complete audio solution. Number two is the value proposition for non-music content is very high. People value it very highly in a subscription service. And I think one of the things that gets, I don't know if you've written about it, but one of the things that I've always been surprised at that when people talk about these services, I've been reading all the Apple news mm-hmm. and coverage. No one ever talks about SiriusXM.
Yeah, yeah.
So SiriusXM is the largest subscription service in the world and the only one by revenue and the only one that makes money. And if you look at how Sirius markets its offerings, it's a lot around the talk content.
Yeah.
Because consumers highly value talk content. Now, they still consume a lot of music on that SiriusXM platform, but what they perceive they're paying for is largely around the non-music content.
Hmm. Interesting.
So when you say what's local, not only is music somewhat local, but clearly the other categories are highly local, whether it's sports, news, politics, weather, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I talk to you about what we're building, we're really building a bundle, like the Sirius bundle.
I see.
Okay. And the bundle has music and non-music content in it.
So you have to custom build it basically for every country.
Yes and no. You have to add different elements of content that are different. On the other hand, as you know, because you've been covering this a lot, I mean, the programming formulas are not dramatically different.
Mm-hmm.
How you program good comedy is very similar. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The actual comedy shows are different.
Let's talk about curation for a second. So I noticed that there's a lot of there's a lot on the website all about your editors that are curating the music. So how does that work? Electronic or an algorithm versus a human. What's the level of each?
So I don't know if you can give a specific number. I think they're both very important. And again, as I said before, different users, different consumers consume music differently.
Mm-hmm.
And curated content, curated playlist is very important. Probably for all users, more important for some than others. And same if you look on the algorithm side. You know, we've always had our own internal solution on the algorithm side. And our usage per user is how I would judge the efficacy mm-hmm. of those. They both have continued to increase. So, like I said, it's one thing to get more and more users, but the most important thing is to get more and more usage because it shows your product's valuable.
Yeah.
I think they both play a really strong role. But again, I think it's hard to say you're going to cover all music, all demos, all genres, all geographies well on day one. And so I think what we've also done is fine-tune both the editorial side and the algorithmic side for different types of users.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Okay, here's the next thing. So I notice you have 35 million songs in the catalog. At what point does less become more?
I think what's important, it's a great question. I think that at a certain point, you know, the next 35 million in one track is less valuable, obviously, you know what I mean, than the tracks that are getting the most consumption. But I would say that, and it's also very important to the user that they have a clean and easy experience. I mean, I think you've seen a lot of the Apple feedback on that.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean, if you can't get to the songs or your songs or songs you want, for instance, if you look at new releases, if they're not organized well, it wouldn't matter whether you had 100 new releases or 10,000, right, if you can't get to what you want.
Yeah.
So clearly, again, we're in a product category, right, where this is driven by the value of the product.
Mm-hmm.
With that said, the catalog matters a lot to the point about geographically and internationally. So if you're a user in the Netherlands, you want to make sure you have all the best Dutch content. So that those tracks may not be important to you here in the U.S., but they're very important to you there. And so I think that's the, and so one of the things that Deezer has done and why we have the biggest catalog in the marketplace is by being in so many markets, we've not only licensed that content locally, when we license content, we license it on a global basis.
Okay.
So if you like salsa from Honduras, you know what I mean? If you're in Honduras, though, while it's almost all going to be consumed in Honduras, some will be consumed in Central America, but there's a certain amount that will be consumed in the U.S. and other markets. And so for you, if you're a salsa fan, that matters.
Right.
You know, I think EDM is a great example, you know what I mean, where it's a very international jazz, classical. There's a number of, you know what I mean, that are very, you know what I mean, very, very international genres.
Yeah. Okay, well, that being said, one of the big complaints about big catalogs is the fact that you have duplicate titles. You have lots of covers, you have karaoke versions, things like that.
Yep.
That makes it very difficult to find the title by the original artist or by the artist that you're looking for. So how do you deal with that?
So we spent a lot of time, and obviously everyone, including us, can do a better job. We spent a lot of time with the metadata to really try and deliver you, like in search, what's relevant, mm-hmm. right? What you're looking for. I think we've come a long way. We have a longer way to go. There are certain areas like classical that are significantly harder because the metadata challenges are bigger.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of how people search and locate and find.
Mm-hmm.
I think we do a good job, you know what I mean? I think on a relative basis, but we can definitely do a better job.
I noticed that you have artist pages, and for the artist, you have a lot of analytics that are available. So as far as the artist pages are concerned, how did that come about, and how important is that?
So artist page, again, like in most things on the service, it's very important to certain users. But it depends on the type of user. So it depends on whether the user is very much artist-centric. And to the extent they are, it's important. And to the extent they're not, it's not. It really depends on the type of user. Again, given the volume of users that we serve every day, there's definitely different types of usage patterns.
I guess it depends on the artist as well, though. If the artist doesn't cooperate on that, then they're not going to have a good artist page, right? Or
that's
the label.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, listen, artists is important, and I think artists and labels are starting to invest more in figuring out how to use that. But it has an area that definitely has room to grow.
You know, that was a big disappointment in Apple Music when it launched. Everybody prior to that thought that was going to be a big selling point, and it wound up that there's nobody there.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I can tell you this from other digital things I've done. It's, you know, the experience, I think you've hit the nail on the head. For a feature to work, whether it's that or other features, you need to meet the expectation that you're constantly going to have great content around the user's interest, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And every time the user, you know what I mean, goes to look.
Yeah.
And so generally what we've tried to do is two things. One is to focus on doing that, but two, it's hard to do that across everything. Which is why I think what you've seen is how we're super serving different segments. That eventually rolls up into super serving all segments.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why I said, again, I think the industry is in its early stages. Again, you know, off the record, I think what Apple did was create extremely high expectation around things that were trying to show that it was different, you know what I mean, or, you know, interesting.
Yeah.
And I just don't think it was there.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a better mousetrap.
Well, hasn't proven to be, that's for sure.
Well, again, I think that Apple has different incentives and different areas of expertise. I personally think Apple is going to pivot to focusing almost exclusively on radio.
Really?
Yeah. And I would not be surprised if they bought Pandora.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
I just think to get the scale that will matter, to get the scale that Apple wants in the time period they want, it's not going to be through paid subscription.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed that you provide lyrics as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's an extra license that you have to get.
That's right. You have to negotiate. Yep. Yeah, and I'm not the licensing guy, but so I can't tell you. The answer is yes.
But again, that makes it more difficult because the more you have to license, and again, you're licensing for the world, wow, those negotiations must be tough.
The negotiations are tough. The payments are tougher. You know, I think one of the challenges in this category that we all share is there's very little margin. And I think that the rights holders have done a disservice by creating a low margin business relative to like video. So you get less investment. And so, you know, it's like I used to work in sports. I was an attorney in sports. And, you know, the league and the players decided to grow a business, you know what I mean, by figuring out what the rational percentage was. That would create the level of investment. I think what's happened is the label, the rights holders themselves are not doing that great, you know what I mean, financially. And so they're trying to extract more and more as from the pie as opposed to focusing on growing the pie.
They're afraid it's actually going to get worse instead of better.
Yes, but again, I think it's actually will likely get much, much better because I think that, that users, it's like TV, which moved from a broadcast advertising business to pay TV. And you could argue, and that's more of what I know, is that today's the golden age of television. That it should be the golden age of music because people are willing to pay for good services, but there needs to be a level of investment to produce the quality good service. And one of the things I think that's gotten lost is, A, the investment necessary in the product, but also if you look at the freemium model, you know, and you look at the backlash by artists and others at, for instance, Apple's, you know what I mean, free trial period. That's a subsidization by, but not by the, but a little by the artist, mostly by the company trying to acquire the subscriber. I mean, we pay 70%+ in royalties. So when we underwrite a marketing investment, you know what I mean, to acquire subscribers, if we, when we get the subscribers, the lion's share of the return goes to the creators, the music creators. So it's, you know, I think some, it's the services have done a poor job PR-wise of explaining this. It's also like explaining to the artist, you know what I mean, the return. But there needs to be a much bigger investment because when you get to 100 million plus paying subscribers, music business is a really good business.
Yeah, I mean, potentially it is, and everybody thinks it's going to get there soon, including me. But, you know, a big problem with investment right now is the licensing issue scares everyone away.
It does. It scares them away because, A, it's unknown, but, B, the percentage. What I'm saying is there's very few media business with such a low gross margin. And so I think the right way to do this is to, you know, is to create a greater incentive to invest. Obviously, you know, we're the second largest, we're investing heavily and we're growing, but as a category, you know what I mean? When you pay 70% off the top, right? And then you pay additional value to create more value, like lyrics, like you're saying, it creates the wrong incentive system, in my opinion. So I think it was a long answer to your question, but.
How much is Deezer paying on an average per stream? Paying back to the rights holder.
Yeah, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but like as I said before, we pay, you know, over 70% of our revenue goes to license fees.
And it's a really tough question anyway, because there, and especially the more levels of service that you have, the more difficult it is to figure that out, you know, more with any kind of precision.
Yes and no, but unfortunately, generally across the board, we're paying 70%+ Again, it's an extremely high percentage. You know, I think, again, what's gotten lost, and I personally am not going to be able to unwind it, but, you know, as I've gotten to learn this industry more, I'm surprised that there hasn't been more discussion about the issue between artists and rights holders, right? When we take a dollar and we turn around and give 70 cents back, the 70 cents is going somewhere.
Yeah, that's always been the problem. There's been the middleman of the record label that's gotten most of it. And even with the publishers, it's kind of the same thing. So that's a big
problem.
But
it's not Deezer and Spotify that's keeping it.
No. I agree with you.
But somehow that's the perception is what I think. With a certain part of the artist community.
Here's a big, broad, global question. Where do you see the industry going? You see some consolidation coming up? Do you see it splintering? What do you see?
I think there'll be a few large global players. In the same way you're seeing Netflix, HBO, et cetera, being very global, you know what I mean, providers on the video side. I think the ones that win, besides being global, will have to have the highest valued bundle proposition. I think you'll see an enormous evolvement of what the bundle is that you're paying $9.99 or more for. I don't think the price point is the problem today. I don't think it's a question about introducing much lower price points, as some have argued. I think it's a question about building more value into the bundle. whether it's high fidelity, whether it's great Latin content, whether it's the best news and politics, right, or whether it's on-demand sports talk. I think all those things are going to become part of the bundle. In the same way, when you first started off with cable, your bundle was pretty much, you know, three or four broadcast channels and, you know, some bad reruns on, you know, three other channels and ESPN.
Yeah, yeah.
And now you have 300 or 500 channels with international channels, HD channels, you know, on-demand, DVR, all those things.
Right.
And so people today really are not complaining anymore about their, you know, $99 plus cable bill because the value is really high. The cord-cutting thing, I think, has been way overestimated in cable. And I think that in the audio space, you really need to see increased bundle value, which is why we bought Stitcher, which is why we're investing in a number of things that we are, to increase the value of the bundle. Just telling a user you have this many songs and you can stream whatever you want is not enough value.
Makes sense. Okay, last question. It's kind of a really broad question. What's the best piece of business advice that you ever received in the business or something that you learned along the way?
The success of a business is almost, someone once told me, the success of a business is driven by the number, by the amount of talent you can acquire to work on it.
Good one. I like that. Very cool. Well, Tyler, it's been great talking.
The talent is, talent very undervalued.
It's interesting you should say that. Because for so long, well, I think there's a prevailing notion today that distribution is king and not talent, not content. But I don't know that I ever bought into that myself.
Well, if you look at television and film, content is king because once you get a number of distributors, if I were a video producer today, I mean, this is an area that I know well. Right now, it's like when Miramax, they can bid their content, even if their old catalog content, against Amazon, Netflix, you know what I mean, Hulu, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So as you have more and more people, and I think you'll see this in the audio, one of your questions, what do I think is going to happen over time? I think you'll see third-party content developers, right, mm-hmm. who will then go to Deezer, Spotify, Apple, et cetera, with content solutions. And once you have large content providers who are competing against each other, what they're competing on ultimately is the content. Not an exclusive song here or there, but great, you know what I mean, ongoing, like you said before, with, you know, when referring to Apple's, you know, Connect. Great content is something the consumer consumes all day long.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to increase in value in all categories as you have larger and larger scale distributors.
Very cool. Tyler, thanks so much for your time. This has been great. I enjoyed speaking with you today.
All right. Well, anyway, I'm in LA all the time. Maybe we'll grab a beer sometime.
That'd be wonderful. I dig it.
All right. I appreciate the time. Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks a lot, Tyler. Take care. You can find out more about Deezer at Deezer.com. That's Deezer.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at EDMMR.com. He helps put the show together. Many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab.